Hi everyone, this is Beverly Tomasi and welcome to our CDE practice test question webcast, Getting to the Right Answer, CDE exam test taking coaching online course. And we have to do a shout out to John because John said he's one of our boot campers. He said, Beverly, why don't you just go through test questions and provide the answers? And that would be really helpful for us to figure out and learn how to dissect test questions and get to the right answer. And so, as always, I listened to all of you and I said, that's a great idea. And you all were very positive about it. So what I did is I put together 48 questions and I said, let's go through these questions. And I did create about, I don't know, 20 new questions. And some of the questions I've included in addition to that are questions that focus on special populations, gestational diabetes, kids. But I did try and choose the questions that are the most challenging. And when I say that, it's questions that include vignettes and extra information that you may or may not need to answer the test question. And so I did email you, and I will put into your online course a PDF of the test questions so you can have them all in one place. That might be helpful for you. And let's get going. I do have some good news to report. We haven't heard back from everybody yet. Not everyone has taken the exam, obviously, because you're here joining us. But 5 of our boot campers have successfully passed the exam. So that is really exciting. And that's just this first week. So what's going to happen in the following weeks? So this is great news. There was over 100 of you who joined our boot camp. And of the 5 that passed, we've got feedback from them about the exam, that there some of them said there was really no surprises. They sat down feeling very comfortable and confident about the information. They did say, though, that a lot of the questions had details you have to sort through and a lot of vignette style. And so I've chosen questions like that today to go over. Vignette style questions, lots of details. Some of them apply, some of them don't apply. But I think why they do this in the exam is to see if you can sort out what is the most important aspect of this patient. So we're always doing assessments of patients. Can you sort through all that detail and figure out what action is required? Figure out, you know, what's blocking that patient from making change, or what are some barriers to care. But all of the people who did take the exam did say the following, that choosing the best answer was very important. So again, some people said that, you know what, there was a lot of, you know, any of the answers seemed like they could have been right, or 3 of the 4. So you really have to do a lot of critical thinking to drill down to what is the best answer. And so, again, I'll be working on that today with all of you. What is the best answer? And so I'm not going to launch these as polls like I have done in the past. I'm just going to go ahead and go over the question together. And I did reorder the questions, so I do apologize, but I had to reorder them to put the ones I really wanted to talk about today. So the question number is correct, and it will match the PDF that I sent you, and it will match the questions on the online courses, but it may not go in the same order. So with that known, but it does match. If it says number 1, it's the first question. Let's get started. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. I really appreciate it. AT is a 43-year-old newly started on insulin. Circle the survival topic that is essential for him to know before discharge. Is it A, managing insulin doses when traveling across time zones? B, how to adjust his insulin dose before exercise? C, signs of hypoglycemia, and D, how to adjust insulin based on carbohydrates consumed. I actually think this is a really good sample question because, it again, you have to figure out what is the key thing that we want to know and what are we looking for in the answers. What is this essential survival topic for someone started on insulin for the first time? That's the critical thing. So is it A, managing doses insulin when traveling across time zone? No, that is not the right answer because that's advanced level knowledge. I mean, he's not even ready for that yet. So I'm sure you all just got rid of that because it's so obviously wrong. How to adjust his insulin before exercise? Well, you could say to yourself, yeah, that's pretty important, but is it the essential thing that he needs to know? Essential survival skill? No, it's not top on the priority list for this patient. Signs of hypoglycemia. Okay. That is very important for anyone on insulin, especially somebody new. So I'm going to put, I'm just going to circle this one thinking this is probably the right answer, but I'm going to keep going. How to adjust insulin based on carbohydrates consumed. He does need to know that, but that is not an essential skill to know before discharge. The essential skill is signs of low blood sugar, and we would add on, of course, what to do. That would be included in our teaching. So a lot of these you could say, well, maybe it really is important to know how to adjust insulin based on carbohydrates, but you have to think, what is the most essential skill this patient needs to survive on insulin and be safe? So that's how I want you all to think. So if you got that right, great job. And if not, you know what? That's okay. It just gives you more information. Let's go on to the next one. JJ is 45 years old and has had type 2 diabetes. Let me just shrink my thing here a little bit. This is poll question 5, by the way, for 5 years. He would like to begin an exercise program which includes jogging 3 times a week with a friend for 2 miles, which takes about 30 minutes. He takes a sulfonylurea to control his diabetes. If his blood glucose is 80 before exercise, how much carbohydrate will he need to consume to prevent hypoglycemia? A, none. B, 15 grams. C, 30 grams. Or D, 45. This is a great example of a question with a ton of extraneous information. So you got to read through it again and figure out what is most critical. He's type 2. Okay, this is very critical. He wants to exercise. He wants to go 3 times a week for 2 miles, which takes about 30 minutes. He's type 2. He's going to exercise for 30 minutes, and he takes a sulfonylurea. So we need to know that a sulfonylurea can cause a low blood sugar. And his blood glucose is 80 before exercise. These are 4 critical things we need to know. Based on that, how much carbohydrate will he need to eat? So type 2. Sulfonylurea. Sulfonylureas can cause low blood sugar. He's going to exercise for 30 minutes. So we know the rule. If you have type 2 diabetes and you're on sulfonylurea or insulin, your blood sugar is less than 100, you're going to take 15 grams of carbohydrate to exercise for 30 minutes. So the answer is 15 grams. How do you know this? There's a table in the handout on exercise we talked about as far as patients needing about 15 grams per hour if their blood sugar is less than 100 and they're on insulin or sulfonylurea. You ready for the next question? This is poll question 3. In the process of providing medical nutrition therapy for a person with diabetes, the goal is to control diabetes, The goal is to improve overall diabetes control by A, providing a written meal plan, B, emphasizing portion control, C, assisting the person to make self-directed behavior changes, or D, using carbohydrate counting. Okay, what's the main intent of this question? The goal when providing MNT is to provide a written meal plan? No, that's not customized for the patient. Portion control? Okay, now this is a juicy answer because we do talk a lot about portion control for people with type 2 diabetes to lose weight. But is this the way we're going to really improve overall diabetes control? Is this the best way? Let's just kind of skip this for a second. C, assisting the person to make self-directed behavior changes. Okay, I'm loving this answer because it has self-directed behavior change. So I'm thinking this is the right answer. It's better than this, emphasizing portion control, because that's more compliance, directive. This one is like, let's engage the patient or using carbohydrate counting. So this one, after reading all the answers, C is obviously the right one, C. MJ is 78 years old with type 2 diabetes, taking 2 daily insulin injections. Since MJ lives alone, which of the following is most important to assess? A, ability to check urine ketones. B, level of activity. C, level of social support. Or D, ability to accurately draw up and inject his insulin. I think this one's pretty straightforward. But again, it's just saying, if they're on insulin, what is most important? I'm just going to go right to the end here. D, obviously, making sure they can withdraw and inject insulin safely. There are questions in the exam about hospitalizations, so that's why I put them up to the front here. So you want to be familiar with some of the basics of hospital management, goals of care, and the importance of not stopping the insulin drip till we give sub-Q insulin. Hyperglycemia during hospitalization is associated with poor outcomes due to what? Decreased insulin resistance, increased insulin secretion, and increased counter-regulatory hormones. Ooh, that's a mouthful. B, increased free fatty acids, ketones, lactate, inflammatory cytokines. C, increased nitric oxide levels. Or D, increased risk of alkalosis. Okay, so this is important to kind of, they're putting, now this is what I would call trying to mess you up with big words. So they're putting a lot of big words in here to try and derail you, but you're not going to get derailed by big words because you know what all this stuff means. So the number one reason we know A is wrong is because during hospitalization, they have increased insulin resistance. When you're sick, you become more resistant because you have increased counter-regulatory hormones. So this is the wrong answer. Increased free fatty acids, ketones, lactate, inflammatory cytokines. I know when people are sick, they're more likely to have inflammation. This looks like the right answer to me. I'm just going to circle it in my mind. C, increased nitric oxide levels. No, increased nitric oxide is good. It helps lower blood pressure. So that's the wrong answer. Increased risk of alkalosis. Wrong. When people are sick, they're at higher risk for acidosis. So the right answer when they have diabetes is B. Okay, let's keep going. Don't get duped by big words. You know, just dissect the big words. Number nine, which of the following statement best reflects the goal of glucose management in the hospital setting? A, better let blood sugars run high rather than low. B, oral medications are the choice to manage, the best choice. C, all patients admitted with a blood glucose greater than 126 should be started on a drip. Or D, insulin therapy is a treatment of choice to manage inpatient hyperglycemia. So we know this is wrong. Of course, you don't want blood sugars to run too high. They're more likely to have complications. Oral medications are not the choice during hospital stay. That is a wrong answer. Oral medications actually should be stopped, and patients should be started on insulin therapy. This is interesting. All patients should be admitted with a glucose greater than 126 should be started on a drip. The reason they put 126, that's a diagnostic criteria for diabetes, right? Fasting 126 or greater. They're trying to pull you into that answer. It's not the right answer because we know that that is not, I'm going to tell you another reason we know it's the wrong answer, the word all. Whenever you see the word all, it's not the right answer. But the correct answer is insulin therapy is a treatment of choice to manage inpatient hyperglycemia. How would you know that? Well, you're going to get rid of wrong answers, but also because the standards of care say so. So be really familiar with the ADA standards of care. So poll question 10 looks at Medicare guidelines, and there are questions in some of the exams about Medicare guidelines. So which of the following are accurate? Patients with type 2 diabetes are covered for 100 strips every 3 months. Patients with diabetes, or B, can retake the group classes every calendar year with approval from referring MD. Or C, Medicare Part A will cover the cost of diabetes self-management program. Or D, under Medicare, only group classes are reimbursed. So let me go through each of these and talk about them. Well, I'm going to start with B and then come back. So this first thing, patients with diabetes can retake their group classes. That is totally false. I want to tell you something very important. Once you have Medicare, you can only take the group classes once in a lifetime. Once you have Medicare, group classes only once in a lifetime, and you cannot exceed 9 hours of group instruction. So for the first year of diabetes, you get 9 hours of group plus 1 hour individual. And you can also see the dietitian for 3 hours the first year and 2 hours every year thereafter. So dietitians, 3 years the first year, 2 years every year thereafter. Diabetes education program, 9 hours a group first year, 1 hour individual, and then 2 hours every year after that. It's every calendar year. So that's really good information to know. Okay, so this is a wrong answer. Medicare A does not cover diabetes self-management. It's Medicare B. So you want to know what part of Medicare covers it. That's the wrong answer. Under Medicare, only group classes are reimbursed. Wrong answer. That, again, we're looking at this word only. Medicare does reimburse group and individual. So the right answer is here. Patients with type 2 get 100 strips every 3 months, but what if they're on insulin? If they're on insulin, the answer is different. They can get more strips as needed and requested by their provider. But if they don't, if they're not on insulin, this is what they get, which translates to about one blood sugar check a day. Okay, let's go to another one. AJ, this is question 39. AJ has been instructed to take Glyburide 5 milligrams twice a day. AJ frequently skips breakfast and his first meal at noon. Oh, and has his first meal at noon. What would be the best recommendation for AJ? So, again, we're looking at best. And we need to know that Glyburide is a sulfonuria. Sulfonurias need to be taken with food because they can lower blood sugar. A, should he test his blood glucose and take Glyburide in the morning if blood glucose is greater than 130? B, take Glyburide before first meal at noon? C, hold morning Glyburide and only take before dinner Glyburide? Or D, insist that AJ eat breakfast and take AM Glyburide? So, A is the wrong answer because you don't base your Glyburide ingestion or taking on your blood sugar. You take the sulfonurias every day. Of course, unless your blood sugars are less than 70, then you need to, you know, call the doctor and downregulate or decrease the dose. So this is wrong. Anyways, he's not eating in the morning, so you don't want to take Glyburide without food. Take AM Glyburide before first meal at noon. That looks right, doesn't it? Because you always want to take the Glyburide with food, associate it with the meal so you don't get low blood sugar. But let's keep going. B looks good. Hold morning Glyburide and only take – no, you don't want to do that because he needs the Glyburide twice a day. Insist that AJ eat breakfast. No, we don't want to do that because we want to work within his life experience. So this is might have lured you in. It's not the right answer. We need to incorporate the patient's life experience and work within their framework. So B is the right answer. Okay, good job, team. Let's keep going. 22. Mr. J is an 89-year-old who lives alone and has mild retinopathy. Okay, this is what the questions are going to look like, a lot of words. His A1C is 9.7, and the MD is written a prescription to start him on intensive insulin therapy. The prescription reads, 3 units of Humalog before each meal, 10 units of Lantus at bedtime. Patient to add 1 unit of Humalog to mealtime dose for every 50 points above 150. What would be the first response to this situation? And I actually skipped the word best. What would be the best first response? Okay, so we have a lot of information about this patient, but what they're saying is this older gentleman with elevated A1C is going home on 4 injections a day. He lives alone and has retinopathy, eye disease. So we're going to consider that when we look at the answers. Contact the prescribing doctor and ask to change the regimen to 10 units 70/30 BID. All right. That's kind of interesting, but it's not what this question is getting towards. So this is, I'm just going to say it's not the right answer because what is the first best response? It sounds too aggressive. Let's keep looking. Start by instructing the patient on how to safely withdraw and inject insulin. Okay, this one is really sounding good to me. Can this patient even withdraw insulin and inject it safely? This, to me, is where we need to start to see, is this really a realistic plan for this patient to go home on? So immediately when we get this order, we would want to say, let's go in the room. Let's talk to the patient. Can they withdraw this? Can they inject it? Could they do it safely? Is this really what B is saying? Is this an appropriate order for this patient given their situation? So B is looking really good to me right now, but I'm going to keep reading. Assess the abilities to inject 4 times a day and calculate insulin based on blood glucose. I actually like this one better. Okay, don't get mad at me right now. But this one, this is how you go through test taking. This one is really even better because more than assessing if he can withdraw safely, I want to know can he inject? Can he calculate how much insulin to take? So I'm going to cross off B and say C is really looking better to me, but let's go to D. Assess a patient's knowledge of hypoglycemia identification and treatment. Okay, that is not what we need to do. So I would say B lured me in, but it's not the right answer because C is a better answer. We want to see if this patient can actually inject four times a day. Can he do that and calculate insulin dose based on his blood sugar? So I would ask him questions like, Mr. Jones, if your blood sugar was 164, how much insulin would you take? And then I would hear what he said. And then if he gave me the wrong answer, then I would know he has not enough cognitive skill to actually succeed at this. So C is the best answer. Thank you for your patience on that one. Okay, let's go to question 15. Mrs. S is having trouble sleeping and complains of waking up with frequent nightmares. Her insulin dose is 5 to 8 units of Novolog at breakfast and dinner and 12 units of MPH at bedtime. She complains that her before bed blood sugar is often greater than 300, so she takes extra insulin before going to bed to bring it down. What is your best response? Your best response. A. Instruct patient to decrease the MPH insulin by 2 units to prevent nocturnal hypoglycemia. Before I go through these questions, I really want to summarize what are we looking for. So we just read that, but what are we really trying to get toward? She does fast-acting insulin before breakfast and dinner and 12 units of MPH at bedtime, but her before bed blood sugar is often high. So when I'm thinking about this, her before bed blood sugar is too high. I'm thinking not enough Novolog at dinner. But this patient is taking extra insulin before she goes to bed. What is your best response? So we always worry when we hear this that patients take extra insulin before going to bed because we're like, wow, what if she gets herself too much insulin before going to bed? What we really want to do is fix the problem. So let's see. Now we have a clear understanding of what we want to do, and that is help this patient safely get her blood glucose at bedtime to closer to target. Okay. A, instruct patient to decrease MPH insulin by 2 units to prevent nocturnal hypoglycemia. Okay, that doesn't make any sense. That is not even the issue. She has high blood sugars before she goes to bed. So that answer doesn't match the question. Contact provider to request discontinue MPH and start Lantus instead. Okay, that doesn't address my problem. Her blood sugar at bedtime is too high, and I don't think Lantus is going to help that. Next, assess that the patient is having a snack before checking her bedtime blood sugar level. I am lured in by this one, but you know what? She doesn't talk about having a snack. It doesn't say she often snacks before she goes to bed. It doesn't bring up a snack or anything like that. So even though I'm lured in by this one, I'm just not thinking it's right. Then I look at D, encourage patient to adjust her dinner time Novolog to prevent hyperglycemia at bedtime. This seems like the right answer. And of course, you know, when we say this, we're going to have to talk to the provider and make this recommendation. But really, we want to adjust her dinner time Novolog. So they're trying to get at the Novolog before dinner needs to be adjusted to get her bedtime blood sugar under target. So D is the right answer. Okay, before I go on, somebody had a question. Okay, that is number 23. Thanks, Shula. I appreciate your help. I have to say, you know, putting a new program together for me it's a lot of work, and sometimes there's little details that I don't catch. So I really appreciate it. This is, you know, our first time providing this webcast, so this is new for me, and it was a lot of work to get it up and running. I'm happy to do it for you guys. I want to be here to help in any way I can. So if you find any goof-ups on my part, hey, let me know, because I am totally open to that. Thank you. Okay, question 24. Mr. C is 47 years old, firefighter. And can I just say something right now? Well, I'm going to just tell you, this is one of the reasons the exam is fatiguing. Because you have to read through all these vignettes. You have to read through vignettes and do critical thinking. What is the most important element of this vignette? So I want all of you right now to stand up, and just stretch and take a deep breath and sit back down. because you're going to need to do a lot of brain clearing to keep the momentum up for this exam and keep focused. So they're going to ask you these questions. You're going to have to sift through them, get the critical points, and get to the right answer. So please feel free to stand up, move around, take a deep breath, you know, wiggle your shoulders, whatever you have to do, because it's intense. It is intense. But you know what? You have 4 hours. You're going to make it happen. Nobody has said to me yet that they didn't have enough time. People have got through the test. Okay. Mr. C is 47-year-old firefighter who injects 15 units of Detomir at night and 10 units of 70-30 in the morning. Well, that's kind of interesting. He also injects Byetta 10 micrograms twice a day. His A1C is 7.3. And his goal is to lower his A1C less than 7. So we just know that Detomir is a long-acting insulin. 70-30 is a combination of basal bolus, 70% basal, 30% bolus. He's also on Byetta. So this is what we're doing as we're going through test questions. We're translating this information in our head. Byetta is a GLP-1 agonist. It's an injection he takes twice a day. His A1C is close to target, but he wants to get it less than 7. His blood glucose levels are in the low 100s in the morning, but frequently above 130 before lunch and above 180 before dinner. What is the best action? Oh, man, we're seeing a lot of this word best today. A. So now we know we want to get that blood sugar before dinner and before lunch a little bit lower. So what's the best action? Encourage him to eat an additional 15 grams of carbohydrate at lunch? No, that would raise his blood sugar. Wrong answer. Hold a 70-30 for a few days to determine his baseline blood glucose during the day and recalibrate his AM insulin dose. Okay, that's just a weird answer. So, you guys, you're going to see weird answers. Don't let him throw you off. You're just like, what? That's just weird. And if it's kind of weird, and sometimes they want to lure you in to choose that weird answer, but it doesn't make sense. That's not the right answer. I've never read that or heard about that. Increase the AM 70-30 to 12 units. Okay, now we're getting warm. So I know his blood sugars are high before lunch and dinner. If I increase the 70-30 to 12, that's only 2 units. That seems like a good idea. And when I write this, you know, these answers here, of course, we talk to the provider. So the questions on the other exam would say contact provider to increase the 70-30 to 12 units. Okay, but this looks good. I'm going to put a check by it. Switch the 70-30 to 50-50 insulin, again, really doesn't make sense to me. Why would I do that? So that's the wrong answer. So the best answer is C, increase the 70-30 to 12 units. Okay, now we have a straightforward one. Are there going to be straightforward questions in the exam? Yeah, there's going to be straightforward questions, but a majority, I want to say, of the questions are embedded in these vignettes with lots of information. Question 25. Which of the following best describes insulin resistance? A, lack of sufficient insulin receptors on fat and muscle cells. B, visceral adipose tissue. C, a physiologic condition where insulin becomes less effective at lowering blood glucose levels. Or D, excessive triglycerides. So you just have to know, you know, what is insulin resistance? And if you weren't that sure about it, you would get rid of wrong answers. This is wrong because there's plenty of insulin receptors on fat and muscle, and the insulin does bind, but the phosphorylation that's supposed to take place in the cell when insulin binds doesn't happen. So those GLUT4 transporters don't get to the cell membrane. So this is wrong. A, visceral adipose tissue. Well, visceral adipose tissue does lead to insulin resistance, but it doesn't describe it. So that's not the right answer. But you can see that is a juicy answer. Visceral adipose tissue is a causative agent of insulin resistance, but it doesn't best describe it. C best describes it. Okay. A physiologic condition. That answers the question. So always get back to the root of the question. What are they trying to get toward? Oh, no, another vignette. Question 33. A patient received 3 units of regular insulin before dinner but couldn't eat due to nausea and vomiting. That's not good. His blood glucose 2 hours after his insulin injection is 82. Which of the following is the best action to prevent hypoglycemia? A, give the patient a glucagon injection. B, give the patient D50 IV push. C, have the patient eat 7 Lifesavers. And D, start an IV of D5. Okay, this is interesting. So this is a patient in the hospital, and we have to figure out what we're going to do. So we have to think, is this a hospital setting or is this a home setting? And I think if I was to rewrite this question, I would be very clear that this is actually in a hospital setting. So let's just keep that in mind. In the hospital setting, when we give the patient a glucagon injection, no, we're not going to do that. We only give glucagon if they're moving toward unconsciousness or unconscious. Will we give him a D50 push? No, we're not going to give him a D50 push because he's awake and alert and he can eat something. But he does have nausea and vomiting. So he has nausea and vomiting, but his blood sugar isn't critical. That's the better response. His blood sugar isn't less than 70, so he doesn't need the IV push. His blood sugar is still 82. So we don't want to give the D50 push. Can we have him eat 7 Lifesavers? No. He's nauseated and vomiting, so nothing by mouth at this point. So we want to make sure that we don't give them anything to ingest. He may just throw it right back up. But the best answer is D, start an IV of D5W, some dextrose and water, because we're not sure when he's going to be able to eat again, and he has insulin on board. Okay, so D is the best answer. Thanks, everybody. Okay, 45. You suspect your 16-year-old client may have disordered eating. Which behavior may be an indication that MZ has disordered eating? A, she avoids all junk food. B, her blood glucose logbook shows blood glucose level at target, but her A1C is 11.2. C, she cuts down on calories when her clothes start getting tight. Or D, she exercises for 30 to 60 minutes each day. Very straightforward question, signs of disordered eating. A, really not a sign. She's maybe eating healthfully. But B is very suspicious. Her blood glucose logbook shows that her blood sugars are normal, but her A1C is 11.2, which is a sign that she's making up her blood sugar levels in her logbook. Maybe she's not checking at all. She's just writing down what we want to see, but we can tell that her blood sugars are high because her A1C is 11.2. So of all of these, B would be the strongest indicator of disordered eating. Okay, question 40. TR is taking 15 units of glargine at bedtime and 4 units of Humalog before each meal. TR is experiencing about 3 episodes of hypoglycemia a week, usually before lunch. What initial change in self-management would you recommend? Okay, so just to kind of summarize again, he's taking long-acting glargine at bedtime and 4 units before every meal, but he's getting 3 episodes of low a week, usually before lunch. So let's just think, if he's getting lows before lunch, I want to take a look to see what's happening at breakfast. I'm just thinking that in my head out loud, because whatever is happening at breakfast is going to affect the pre-lunch blood sugar. What initial change would you recommend? Would we decrease the glargine by 2 units? No, that's not the problem. He's not low in the morning before breakfast. That's not the problem. It's between breakfast and lunch. Will we decrease the Humalog before breakfast? Oh, that looks really good. He's not just having 1 episode a month of low. He's having 3 a week. That is really significant. So action is required. So this decreasing the Humalog before breakfast looks really good to me because we want to give him less insulin at breakfast so he stops getting low at lunch. I'm just going to put a check by it. Ask TR to monitor 2-hour postprandial glucose level. Well, you could do that, but why? He keeps getting low, so we don't really need to do that. It's not going to help. Ask TR to increase his carbohydrate intake by 15 grams at breakfast. Okay, juicy answer, juicy, juicy. You want to choose this. He's getting low between breakfast and lunch. But if we increase the carb intake at breakfast, what's going to happen? He's going to gain weight. That's called feeding the insulin. We don't want to feed the insulin. We want to cut back on the insulin to help get his blood sugars to target. So this is the wrong answer, but it's juicy. It's going to lure you in. The right and best answer, the initial change, would be to decrease the Humalog before breakfast. That will help keep him safe, which is number one important. Poll question 41. KL is a 24-year-old being treated for DKA. What is the most important action to take before the insulin drip is stopped? Okay, this is an important question. It comes up on the exam sometimes, so I would just be really familiar with this. I want to say something that IV insulin has a half-life of about a minute. Once you stop the IV insulin, there's no insulin in the bloodstream. So keep that in mind. Do we want to start IV of D5 dextrose? No, we don't want to do that. This is what action should we take before the insulin drip is stopped. That doesn't even match the question. Do we want to monitor for hypokalemia, low potassium? Yeah, we're always monitoring for hypo and hyperkalemia when a patient is in DKA. But that's not the most important action to take. What is the most important action to take? Is it make sure there is a glucagon emergency kit in the room? No, we're stopping the insulin drip. He's not likely to go low. He's likely to go high. So the most important action to take is D, give sub-Q insulin. We know the half-life of IV insulin is very short. He needs IV insulin. I'm sorry. He needs sub-Q insulin injected before we stop the IV insulin, so that way he doesn't go back into DKA. Okay. Let's take a look at Mr. Pasteur. Mr. Pasteur started on the following insulin regimen: 22 of MPH and 10 units of regular before breakfast, 5 units of regular before dinner, and 10 units of MPH before bedtime. So we know MPH is an intermediate acting insulin. Regular is, you know, fast acting bolus. His BMI is 33. His evening blood glucose levels are what? They're above target, 180 to 210. What is the target for evening blood sugars? Less than 180. So we want to keep in mind that he's not wildly above the blood sugar target. Which of the following changes would best help him get his blood glucose levels to goal? Would we increase before dinner MPH insulin? No, that is the wrong answer, because before dinner MPH insulin affects morning blood sugar. So that would not help. Would we increase the PM, I'm sorry, would we increase the AM NPH insulin? No. Morning MPH insulin affects before dinner blood sugar. That's not going to help. Would we increase the dose of regular insulin before dinner by 30%? Now that's interesting. He's at 5 units now. Would we go up by 30%, which is 1.5 unit, to 6.5? Well, that is a juicy answer, but it's not the right one, because I've never read of a rule that says increase it by 30%. And we're trying to figure out what would best help him get his blood levels, glucose levels to goal. So this is going to be the wrong answer, because the better answer and the best answer is to evaluate carbohydrate intake at dinner. And so we want to say, you know, if he was running, you know, 230s at bedtime, or 250 or 300, then we might move more toward increasing insulin. But since he's so close to target, we could just look at evaluating carbohydrate intake at dinner, and that would help get that post-meal blood sugar closer to target. So whenever we can, when working with patients, we want to adjust food and activity before increasing insulin, because insulin helps people gain weight, and we always want to give the least amount of insulin we absolutely can give people, especially with type 2. D is the right answer. Okay, we have a straightforward one maybe. John has uncontrolled type 1 diabetes for 10 years. What are the signs he has autonomic neuropathy? So we just need to know, what is autonomic neuropathy? Well, it's neuropathy that affects the nerves, the sympathetic nervous system. And so let's take a look and see what the answers are. excess perspiration on lower extremities and gastroparesis. So gastroparesis is right. Gastroparesis is slowing of the stomach movement because of neuropathy, but excess perspiration is not an autonomic neuropathy sign. Actually, people with diabetes sweat less from the waist down. They have dry skin. Bradycardia and skin infections. Okay, so slow heart rate. That is really not a sign of autonomic neuropathy. With skin infections is just a sign of hyperglycemia. So both of these are not signs of autonomic neuropathy. Gastroparesis, here it is again, and fixed heart rate. Yes, we know that people with autonomic neuropathy get this thing called cardiac denervation, where their heart rate doesn't increase with exercise, and they also get gastroparesis. So this looks like the right answer, but let's keep going. Hypotension and acanthosis nigricans. Well, we know that acanthosis nigricans is associated with insulin resistance in type 2. And so that is not the right answer. So the right answer is C, gastroparesis and fixed heart rate. Okay, good job, everybody. We're on 44. How are your brains doing? Let's just stand up again, because we're remembering during this exam we're going to stand up and stretch. So everybody just take a moment. Stand up, lift your arms up, take a deep breath. Yeah, you're going to do so great on this exam because you're going to be focused, alert, and you're going to be just ready to go. And you're going to put your hands on your hip if you're feeling nervous. If you put your hands on your hip, that's going to decrease your adrenaline and help increase your testosterone and your focus. So during this exam, you're going to talk kindly and gently to yourself. You're halfway through. You know, you're doing a great job. I am just so proud of all the work you've done to get to this point. You're going to be coaching yourself in this really positive way, and you're just going to say, you know what, you're almost there. All your hard work is paying off. You're making it through this exam. And honestly, you guys, you know, whether or not you pass, and I know you're so much more likely to pass than a lot of people, because you're doing this boot camp, you're listening to this webcast, you're getting all the tools you need to really succeed at this exam. But the truth is, regardless, look at all the information you've gained as a result of studying for this exam and how much better prepared we are to help our patients with diabetes. And so that's really important to keep in mind too. Okay, let's keep going. Poll question 44. Of the following, which risk factor combination is most predictive of retinopathy? Oh, so retinopathy is eye disease. Hypertension and prolonged hypoglycemia. Well, I definitely know that hypertension increases risk of retinopathy, but not prolonged hypoglycemia. That's not the right answer. Hypertension and hyperglycemia. I definitely know that both of those increase risk of retinopathy. I'm putting a check there, but I'm going to keep going. History of stroke and hyperglycemia. I think this is tempting, but not the right answer, because it's not a risk factor per se. The hypertension is a risk factor, so we're looking for risk factors. So I'm tempted by that, but I'm going to say no. History of previous foot ulceration or amputation. No, that's not really predictive of retinopathy. We know the two factors that increase the risk of retinopathy are hypertension and hyperglycemia. So B is the right answer. Okay, let's see. Question 46. During a diabetes education session, you notice your patient on insulin is beginning to sweat profusely and having difficulty speaking. What is the best action? Get a meter. Okay, so getting back to the intent of this question, why are they telling you she's sweating and having difficulty speaking? Well, we know she has low blood sugar. Sweating is a sign of low blood sugar. But when you hear this difficulty speaking, I want to tell you what that means. That means she's running into severe hypoglycemia because it's affecting her cognition. She's getting into neuroglycopenia. So whenever people might be acting drunk or like belligerent, or they're having a hard time pulling their words together, you know that their brain is not getting enough glucose. It requires fast action. Okay, so that's the significance of this information. So you need to as you look at these questions, figure out what is the important information in these questions they need to bring to help me figure out the answer. And that's kind of the critical thinking aspect of this exam. Okay, are you going to get a meter to check her blood sugar levels? No way, because she's on insulin. She has low blood sugar. Skip the meter. Don't get a meter. It takes too long. We need to go straight to go. She needs carbohydrate, and she needs it fast. Give her glucose gel. What is that? Well, you may or may not know what that is, but it's a gel that has carbohydrates, 15 grams of carbohydrates that will raise her blood sugar. So this looks really good. And the reason that this is the best is you don't have to chew it. You just suck it. It's like icing. And so if she's having difficulty speaking, she may have difficulty chewing and swallowing. We want to be very cautious. Okay, this looks good to me, but I'm going to keep reading. See, call the doctor for orders. I'm not going to do that. I need to do something right away. Wrong answer. Am I going to give her half a glucagon injection? No, I'm not going to do that. I mean, she's outpatient. Where would I get the glucagon unless I have it in my office? But she's still speaking. So if she's still speaking and she's not vomiting and she can swallow, we're going to give her glucose gel. So that is the best answer. I'm sure you guys got that right. Poll question number two. Oh, I'm going back to some now more straightforward questions. Which of the following are characteristics of peripheral arterial disease? So I have a little saying how I remember about peripheral arterial disease. Hair don't grow where, no, take that back. Grass don't grow where water don't flow. So PAD means the circulation is having a hard time getting to lower extremities. That's what PAD is. So are ingrown toenails a problem with PAD? No, that's not a problem with PAD. That's just maybe a misshapen toe or just a chronic problem that person has. Pulses difficult to palpate due to edema. Well, this is interesting because people with PAD do have pulses that are difficult to palpate because the circulation's not good, but it's not due to edema. Their foot is not edematous. Their foot is shiny and oftentimes, it's very, it's not swollen. It's kind of skinny and shiny, I would say, would be a typical presentation of a foot with poor circulation. Callus formation on the ball of the foot. No, that's really not PAD. That might be from neuropathy or walking funny or you have a bad fitting shoe. But the answer is intermittent claudication because you don't have good enough circulation in the lower extremity. So when you walk, you don't get enough oxygen and they get that pain associated with walking that is relieved when they sit down. So D is the right answer. Okay, number 47. AT is a 43-year-old newly started on Lantus at bedtime. Circle the survival topic that is essential for AT to know before discharge. So again, this is a patient in the hospital. And they're going home on a once-a-day injection of a long-acting insulin. A, how to adjust Lantus dose based on bedtime glucose? Wait a minute. Do we adjust Lantus based on bedtime glucose? No, we don't. Lantus is always a steady dose. You don't adjust Lantus based on blood sugar as far as like a sliding scale. You do adjust Lantus based on what that morning blood sugar trend is. And so you do look at trends in the morning and adjust based on that. But it's not like, oh, I'm going to adjust it up or down now because what the blood sugar is. It stays in more in a steady state. So that's the wrong answer. How to adjust Lantus insulin dose based on AM blood glucose. Okay, I'm kind of interested in this one, so I'm going to put a little star here. Goals for AM blood glucose. This I really like a lot. I'm going to circle it. Because this person is newly started on Lantus at bedtime, I want them to know what is the goal for morning blood sugar. I don't want it below 70, and I want it below 130, and that's what we're shooting toward. If it's less than 70, I want that person to know they need to call their provider, and we need to reduce the Lantus dose. And if it's running too high, call the provider. So this is looking like the right answer, but let's go to D. How to adjust insulin dose based on carbs consumed? No, that's not the right answer because we already know you don't adjust Lantus based on carbs. So it was between B and C, but when I got to C, I realized C is the right answer. They're newly started on Lantus. They're not going to be adjusting it right away. We just want them to know what the goal for AM blood sugar is. C is the right answer. Okay, number four. For a person with type 2 diabetes who is using intensive diabetes therapy, meals and snacks can be scheduled according to what? And just when we say intensive diabetes therapy, what does that mean? It's three shots of bolus insulin a day and a long-acting insulin once a day. And intensive insulin therapy, they're actually going to do carb counting and adjust their insulin based on not only their carbs but their blood sugar before meals. Okay, so meals and snacks can be scheduled according to what? Usual eating habits, insulin action times, calorie content, or meal spacing. Well, this is actually right out of the DCCT where they said A is the right answer. Let's match the insulin to the people. Let's ask what their usual eating habits are and give them and arrange their insulin therapy, their insulin, let them have the flexibility when they eat, how much they're going to eat, and they can adjust the insulin based on that. So it should be scheduled according to their usual eating habits. That's really important. It kind of comes back to that question we asked earlier about that person who skips breakfast and she takes glyburide. Are we going to insist she eats breakfast every day, or are we going to say take glyburide before your first meal? We're going to say take glyburide before the first meal because we want to base our therapy on the patient's usual eating habits. Okay, 48. One of the most important factors to consider when individualizing a meal plan for a person with diabetes includes A, medical history and type of diabetes, B, laboratory data and weight. Oh, these are two of the same answers. Sorry. C, laboratory data and weight, or D, cultural background and food preferences. So we know B and C is wrong because the teacher made a mistake, so it's between A and B. This is actually a really important question. Do we base on a meal plan? Let me just say that differently. What is one of the most important factors to consider when individualizing a meal plan? Most important. Is it medical history and type of diabetes? Maybe for the healthcare professional, we're thinking about that, but for the person living with diabetes, we need to incorporate their food preferences and their cultural background. So this kind of gets back to the heart of the exam, saying, let's start with the individual. Let's see what their needs and desires and preferences are. Let's start with where they are, not with the medical data and the pathophysiology. Start with the person and their preferences. And for that reason, D is the right answer. Okay, 26. Which factor is often associated with insulin resistance? Hypergonadism, acanthosis nigricans, excessive hunger, or waistline less than 35 inches? Okay, so another question looking at insulin resistance. Hypergonadism is not related to insulin resistance. Acanthosis nigricans definitely is. That's a darkening of the skin where the body bends or rubs together, so that looks good. Excessive hunger is not associated with insulin resistance. It's associated with hyperglycemia, especially, when the blood sugar levels are very high. Waistline less than 35 inches, juicy question. If this said more than 35 inches, it might be the right one, but it says less than, so we know that's wrong. So B is the right answer. I'm going to skip this question because it's very similar to another one. Let's keep going. 28. According to the CDC, what best describes the future prevalence of diabetes in the United States? Do you need to know prevalence of diabetes? You might need to, they might ask some questions about prevalence, about, kind of the epidemic of diabetes. So it was good to be familiar with those stats, that about 25% of people with diabetes have it and don't know it. But on this one, you could go through and see which seems wrong. Any answer that says 50% of people will have type 2 diabetes, it doesn't even give a date or a year. That's wrong. The rate of type 1 and type 2 will triple by the year 2050. So type 1 is increasing, but it's not increasing at that dramatic of a rate. Type 2 is really increasing dramatically, more than type more than type 1, but this is a little bit too dramatic. So that doesn't seem right. One out of three persons will have type 2 diabetes by the year 2050. This is the right answer. 35% of our population, if we don't do something now, will have diabetes by the year 2050. Poll question 29. Which of the following interventions is most likely to decrease the prevalence of diabetes in the United States? Which of the following is most likely? A, encourage people to drink more red wine. Wow, I like that answer. It is true that I talked about this earlier, that wine does, if you have diabetes, decrease your blood sugars. But we do know that if people drink more than two drinks a day, their risk of diabetes goes up. So, but red wine does have some protective diabetes effects, but this is not the right answer because people might misinterpret that recommendation. It's not specific enough. B, wrong answer on A. B, community-based programs that promote daily healthy lifestyle activities. That sounds really good. Oh, C, taxing sugary drinks. That's really interesting because in Berkeley, they just passed a law that there is going to be a tax on sugary drinks in Berkeley, California. So that was a big victory for the public health campaigners, and maybe we'll see more of that. But that might help, but B would help more. So even though that's a great idea, I think B would be more effective. How about this, increasing availability of gastric bypass surgery? Wow, that's not going to decrease the prevalence. Many people are getting gastric bypass to treat diabetes, but that's a very, you know, dramatic intervention. So B is the right answer. That was pretty obvious. Okay, according to the American Diabetes Association standards of care, who should be screened for, it doesn't say type 2, for type 1 diabetes? A. And this is right out of the standards of care. High-risk individuals based on family history of autoimmune disease. B, all teenagers at puberty. C, high-risk ethnic groups. Or D, all individuals starting at the age of 45. So we know that type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease, and it's really much more likely in individuals who have a family history of type 1 diabetes or other autoimmune diseases. So it would not be cost-effective to screen all teenagers at puberty. The high-risk ethnic groups, it's not as a differential as with type 2 diabetes. It does mostly affect Caucasians, type 1 diabetes, that is true. But it's not as differential as type 2, I would say, in general. I could be wrong on that, but that would not be an effective strategy. D, all individuals starting at the age of 45, oh, wow, that would be very expensive, and it wouldn't really help us find the people that we need currently with the testings we have. So now with the testing programs we have available and the labs that we have available to us, this is the best answer. High-risk individuals based on family history of autoimmune diseases. And there is a program called TrialNet. And TrialNet wants anyone with a family history of type 1 diabetes to contact them because they want to follow the natural history of type 1 diabetes and see if there's any interventions that we can provide to help halt the destruction of the beta cell. Okay, which of the following is the correct glucose goal for a 6 to 12-year-old child with type 1 diabetes? So they will ask you pediatric questions, and in the handout for kids and diabetes, we do talk about the goals for kids in this age group, school-aged children. So you want to be familiar with that. And generally speaking, I would say for school-aged children, the glucose goal is a little bit higher to prevent hypoglycemia. And so that this is where we currently are at. So is it a prenatal blood glucose of 70 to 130? No, that's just that's the usual blood sugar goal for, you know, adults with diabetes. So this isn't, it needs to be different because this is for kids who are higher risk. Post-meal blood glucose less than 200. No, that's not right. It's kind of tempting, but it's not the right answer. A1C lesson 7, no, actually, they let the kids' A1C go a little bit higher just to help prevent hypoglycemia. So the answer here is pre-meal glucose between 90 to 180. So you can see there's a lot more room for safety and helping to prevent hypoglycemia. So if you get a question like this, just think, these children are at higher risk for low blood sugar. We want to keep them safe. What are symptoms of angina for people with diabetes and cardiac autonomic neuropathy? So again, this cardiac autonomic neuropathy means they don't feel chest pain in the same way that people without CAN, cardiac autonomic neuropathy, feel it. So, would they feel fatigue, dyspnea, and diaphoresis? Okay, that's interesting. Let's go to B. I'm going to just put a little check by that. I'm thinking that's right. Crushing chest pain. Nope. If you have autonomic neuropathy, you're not going to feel crushing chest pain. You're not going to feel the pain of a heart attack. Pain radiating to the jaw, you're not going to feel that. Burning pains in legs, I don't even know what that is. That's just kind of weird. That's one of those weird answers. So the right answer is this. Any patient who has diabetes and starts complaining of fatigue, dyspnea, diaphoresis out of the blue, we're really going to think that they're having a cardiac event and they need to get care immediately. Very, very important, because they may not have those typical symptoms. We have like one more minute. We're at 12:30. Choose the correct inpatient glucose goals for non-critical patient. So this is on the inpatient side. Fasting glucose less than 126. No, you know what that is? That's diagnostic criteria. That's not right. Post-meal glucose less than 200, nope, that's not right. Pre-meal glucose less than 110, nope, that's not right. Pre-meal blood glucose less than 140, yes, this is right. So how would you know this? Well, it talks about it in the ADA standards of care and also in our hospital presentation. So it's noon, right? It's 12:30. I don't want to go any longer than I said I would. We covered 1 hour worth of questions, and I hope that was helpful for you. There's a few more, but the answers are on our online course. And if you have any additional questions, you can email me. And as always, as soon as I sign off, I'll be here to answer any other questions. And I want to thank you so much for joining us. I hope you found that helpful on going through the test questions, figuring out what is the key intent of these questions, eliminating the wrong answer, and boiling it down to the best answer. And that's what you're going to do during the exam. You're just going to find out the key intent and really summarize what the question is asking, and then look at the answers, get rid of the wrong answers, and look at the best answers that are remaining and say to yourself, which of these is the absolute best answer? That's going to be the key to this. And if a question seems weird or confusing, just let it go. Go on to the next question and keep breathing. Take stand-up breaks, stretch, move around, and, you know, be your own best coach. I talk about this a lot. But you really want to say to yourself, you know what? You're doing great. You've answered 25 questions. You have a few more to go. I know, but just keep going. So you want to, you know, coach yourself forward. And if there's a question that throws you off, you're going to say, that's okay. That's just one question. I'm going to keep going. And don't get discouraged. Just approach each question, you know, just fresh and ready to go. Don't let the other questions linger in your memory. Just move on to the next question. And as I've said already, we've got success notice that 5 of our boot campers have passed, and that's just the first week of the exam. So over 100 of you joined us, so I'm sure I'm going to be getting a lot more emails saying that you've passed. And when you do pass, please let us know. Tell us about the exam, or we're, you know, paying it forward to the rest of you. And we're here to support and coach you all the way. So I'm going to sign off, but I will stay for questions. So this is Beverly Tomasian. Thank you so much. Please keep in touch and let us know how it goes.